You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the horrible beauty of industrial devastation.
There's a lot of reasons to be somewhat awestruck by what we're capable of creating and building. So I think there's an act of creation. And in that act of creation, there's obviously equal or greater acts of destruction.
Wait for that. Let's do something here. I want you to close your eyes for a second and tell me what you see when I ask you this question. What does Canada look like? Maybe you're seeing great rocky mountains, shimmering lakes, vast prairies, frozen tundra, dense forests. That is the postcard of the Great White North. That is our cartoon backdrop. That is, I think, what a lot of people see when they picture Canada. But it's not what Ed Bertinsky sees. Those are not the pictures that he's shown us. If you've never seen Bertinsky's stuff, I'll try to describe them. These are huge prints. These are like, some of them are like 9 feet by 18 feet. That's bigger than your living room wall. That's like three of me across. And every inch of these images is packed with visual detail. I guess he's technically a landscape photographer, but man, these landscapes. He shoots them from the sky. He used Cessna planes and helicopters back when he started in the 80s. These days, he also uses state-of-the-art drones to get these images. And they are huge prints of huge areas, just vast aerial shots of what he calls manufactured landscapes. Mountain ranges, scarred and scooped from mining operations and from quarries, tar sand tailing ponds that look as wide as the Great Lakes, and fractaling river systems of red industrial sludge. These are nature shots of places where we humans have destroyed the nature. This is the opposite of unspoiled nature. This guy specializes in spoiled nature. He's basically taking pictures of Mordor. These are industrial hellscapes. His pictures are stark, brutal evidence of the damage that we have done at scale. So how come they're so pretty? Taste is subjective. This guy's controversial. I'm no art critic. But Ed Bertinsky is... If you haven't seen these pictures, if you haven't seen the actual prints of these pictures in a gallery, well, you should. I have, admired is the wrong word, but I've seen his work for years now, and I want to talk with him about them because I still don't know how to feel about them, and I want to talk to him about pictures themselves. Seriously, what's the point? Aren't podcasts much better? All right, well, Ed Bertinsky's newest work is called The Great Acceleration. He's won countless awards. He has 9 honorary doctorate degrees. The guy's an officer of the Order of Canada. His work is collected and displayed in top galleries around the world. He is probably the most famous Canadian art photographer in the world. He's going to join me in our studio in a moment. Wait for it. Your work was introduced to me as, you got to look at this stuff. This will really show you the scale of how humans have ravaged the planet. And I didn't really know much about the oil sands, the tar sands, before I saw your work. And so this was sort of presented to me as proof, evidence, almost as propaganda for the movement against industry and fossil fuel extraction. There was a context that was presented to me. And then I heard other people respond very differently to your work, people in the environmentalist movement criticizing your stuff and saying, these images are too beautiful. This guy is glorifying industrial devastation. He's interested in the aesthetics of these horrors that we're inflicting upon the world. Here's a quote from a recent review in the newspaper, The Guardian, and I think this makes the point nicely. Berchinsky imbues his work with an undeniable beauty, a fact that has sometimes made critics uneasy. Shots like that of an enormous step wall in Rajasthan or the Chino mine in Silver City, New Mexico are mesmerizing in their intricacy, their arrangement of color, and the hypnotic way that Berchinsky has framed the innumerable lines within. Goes on to call your photographs of environmental destruction gorgeous. So what's the Berchinsky position on the Berchinsky pictures? Are these pro-Earth pictures or pro-industry pictures? Are you good or evil?
I'm trying to actually remain kind of as an observer in as neutral a position as I can be, given what I know and given what I've seen. I'm trying to point out that, you know, what I'm photographing is really business as usual. So I'm not a disaster aesthetic photographer. These are all things that, you know, these companies have a license to do this. They've gotten permission from the governments and they've gone through environmental regulations, whatever they may be, and they've gone into all of the labor issues as they need to create these businesses, and they're extracting things. And one can argue that they're providing a service. I worked as an underground miner, and I understand that there's a challenge in that work. People make a living from that, and that we can't kid ourselves that we don't, to survive as a species with the technological revolution we have, that we could do that without materials. So, and materials come from one place. That one place is called nature. So as much as I have a deep place and understanding and a profound respect for nature, I also understand that we need to take from it to live the lives that we've come accustomed to. When I've heard people say, well, it's terrible what's happening, I'm saying, well, just think of your life from the moment you get up. And so you, whatever your feather pillows made out of the cotton sheets, they might have come from somewhere in Turkestan or wherever that does cotton, who knows. But it's all coming from around the world. You turn off your alarm clock or your phone, and it's made of products from all around the world. The electricity coming into your house is coming from a nuclear power station, which is tons of copper, aluminum, all of that. You go over to your sink, just think of all the infrastructure to pump water. So you got water pressure, so the filter, the cleaning tanks, and the stainless steel, you know, knob on your tap. We're engaged in tons and tons of material in our first 5 minutes of our existence every time we get up in our... So we live in a place where it's complex, and that if we're going to continue to grow and to build more houses and to have more people and bringing in immigration and all of these things, that all comes at a material cost. To me, it's too simplistic to say it's wrong or it's right. It's what it is. And I'm using my camera in a way to find a language, a visual language, in which you look at something and it invokes a kind of sense of wonder or curiosity, or where is this? Or how come I've never seen anything like this? As an artist, I'm not a policymaker, I'm not a politician, but I can kind of tell our stories in a way through my photograph and through my camera. And this is, I think, one of the most profound stories of our time.
You're telling a story, you're taking pictures of real things, you're a messenger, as you describe yourself. Are you a journalist?
I take from journalism. I think that there is embedded, you know, storytelling. Like when I go and photograph the Three Gorges Dam, for instance, well, you know, that's the biggest dam ever built in the world. So there is a newsworthy story being told, although not. Does somebody say, go and photograph for we're doing a story in the three biggest? Maybe Nat Geo might send to somebody else, or there might be some magazines that might want that. Mm-hmm. But it's more I'm doing my own kind of research and asking myself, like, where's the next place I think I can show scale of human engagement, you know, on the planet, whether it's farming or the biggest dam in the world or the biggest factory in the world or the biggest copper mine in the world? Where can that be? And then how do I get there? How do I do all that? So it shares with journalism. It shares with documentary photography. And it shares with the world of fine art, abstract expressionism, and the flattening of space, and the all-overness, and color, and line, and gesture. All these things are also at work, so that when you approach the work, it might not even appear, you know, as a mine. You wouldn't think of that. I'm looking at a mine.
No, it's abstracted. It takes a minute.
Yeah, so I'm adding a lot of levels of abstraction and painterly traditions and sharing from, you know, the history of art, history of photography, and embedding those things in there too. If you've studied the history of art and photography, you would see the reference points I often would include in the work. So there's that. I don't know if journalists would be thinking along those lines. Maybe yes.
We're typically artless But yeah, every now and then we have our moments.
You get something that really excites you and you want to pursue it, yeah.
Backing up to your relationship with just industry itself, the argument you were making, which is just true, that it's almost impossible to live in this world without being a part of a system that relies on this industrialization. It's complicated, and I know that your biography around this is complicated. You talked about your dad dying from cancer when you were a teenager due to workplace carcinogens at the GM factory where he worked, and then you took a job at that same factory cleaning that toxic oil that likely killed your dad. Am I reaching here, or would it be correct to say that you're negotiating a pretty dramatic relationship with industry for a long time?
Both, I think, in a sense of curiosity. I do find that as a species, we're pretty ingenious, and we've figured a lot of stuff out. There's a lot of reasons to be somewhat awestruck by what we're capable of creating and building. So I think there's an act of creation. And in that act of creation, there's obviously equal or greater acts of destruction, because that's just like the way it is. That's the way of creation, is that there's an equal or greater amount of destruction in that creation. And that's unfolding all the time. But in industry, you know, I removed those PCB oils and then said I'm not going to work in a factory anymore. I just thought it was such a dangerous place to work. I understood how dangerous it was because that oil, those oils that all the men there who were, none of them hit 50, died from, was everywhere. It was on the machinery. It was anything you're touching. It was the pneumatic. So all of that squishes out onto the pipes and it's just coated. The whole line is coated in that oil. Then I, you know, end of the day, I'd blow my nose and it was just a black Kleenex. I'm going, this just can't be good. I don't want to live in this world. And it killed my father. And I think there's another better life. And I wanted to be out in the world. I just wanted to be free, out of, away from a desk. And so photography really was a driver to also just get me away from that.
Like somebody else from that experience would conclude a story about bad guys, right? Somebody else that would set them off on a life of crusading, and Aaron Brockovich. There are industrial captains here who are indifferent to the suffering of their own employees. What somebody else might take from that is different than, well, we create, we destroy, but there's a cost. It's a much more thoughtful, I guess, forgiving, but also broad, like a wide-angled understanding of what's going on.
Because these things, these places do provide well-paying jobs, and these things we use every day, cars, or homes, everything. So it is, it's woven into, like, who we are, you know, as a species. In any given industry, call it mining or the auto industry or the coal, there's going to be the good, the bad, and the ugly. You're going to have really good actors who are working as best they can, and they've got great workers' policies and rights and all of that, and they've got a great environmental record, and they're doing it right, and they're contributing back to the community, and they're providing a lot of work and a service that's allowing people to heat their homes and get to work. So you can look at it that way. I kind of do stand back and look at the human species as a kind of a complex experiment unfolding. And it's pretty easy to take the position of there's good guys and bad guys. But I think to me it wasn't useful in my arguments. And also to really be able to get, call it the permission, and that's an important thing, to go into these places. If I was a card-carrying environmentalist and said, I am against what you do, and I'm going to photograph these pictures and associate a group of words that I will create that will be an indictment against what you do.
Come on in.
Come on in. That would be the last time I do it. And with the internet, I wouldn't last very long.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of float in this more of the observer and in the revelatory versus accusatory mode. And so I'm pulling the curtain back. I'm saying, look, take a look. It's here. I'm showing you something. And you take that information. And it's the same in the film. When we were working with Jennifer Bechtold and Nick DePonce, we always talked about that. Let's let the viewer feel the things that we're showing, absorb them, and then find their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. And I think if people find their own conclusion, they're more prone to own it than being told someone else's opinion about what's going on. I think if you get there yourself and you say, there's something on there we should be careful of, we should be aware of, and I think I could do something in my life that can help mitigate that, and even in that small way, Or I see something and I decide I'm going to go, and I've had this happen many times and when I speak, and I'm going to go into environmental studies, or I'm going to make a more meaningful life because I'm going to go and start to help deal with these issues that are very real, and I'm going to use my energy to try and help correct that human action that's causing problem. So I think those are all positive things, and I think creating a space, and also, and we again, with Jennifer and Nick, we used to talk a lot about this, is you can create work that speaks to the choir, and they're going to get it, and they're going to say, yes, thank you for championing and showing us these things and all that. And so that choir might be the environmentalists, or might be people concerned for the planet, might be people who love nature.
But they have a pre-existing interest in the subject.
Yeah, call that the choir. And then there's those who deny and say, no, there's nothing wrong. This is nature doing what it does. It's getting hotter. These storms are normal. This is what's going to happen anyways. Look, we've had ice ages, and then it's not humans.
Whatever kind of skepticism or denialism.
Yeah. And then there's going to be one, and there's going to be a camp that's you're never going to move. And then there's going to be this group, I think, that still might be brought under the tent, that are still saying, I just need to see something that somebody doesn't tell me what to think, but I come to that conclusion myself that there's something there that needs to be considered. And we are always hopeful that the way we present the work, and the way I present the work, I've also done that, allows somebody who may be a skeptic and may begin to feel that there is something that they should be paying attention to, and that maybe next time they vote, they might take that into consideration in voting to see if what they're voting for has, what's their opinion on the environment, and what's their opinion on putting in green incentives or things of that nature, so that we're actually starting to course correct.
I think that everything you just said is what a journalist might say who's trying to do deep, thoughtful work. Show, don't tell, don't speechify to people, lay it out, let them come to their own conclusions, find an interesting way to engage with people to an outcome of putting more people under the tent and influencing their voting decisions. And not to negate that that's definitely a process that can happen with your work, but I don't think that's all that happens. The missing piece in that description is awe. My kid, when he was like 1.5, the first thing, you know, as kids form little obsessions, the first thing he was obsessed with was industry, was excavators. He knew the names of these things: backhoe, dump truck, excavator. If we happened across somewhere where they were doing a demolition, wow, rapt for hours. And this was just a child's awe with what humans can do at a certain scale. That's present in your work, which is not the same thing as, wow, we really are destroying our planet. I think that there is some intentionality in the way that an artist composes a picture with reference to great works of art of history, and this tension between something that we're told is ugly and destructive but presented in a way that you can't deny. It evokes an aesthetic response, and some of the work of vast fields of abandoned tires, it's like, that's kind of beautiful. You're showing people things they've never seen before, and so that awe is still there.
It's kind of searching for an iconography around this. Kind of way, shorthand for, I'm going to show you a copper mine, and the reason why I'm showing you this one usually is because it's the biggest one in the world. So I do research on scale. I'm looking for scale.
Yeah,
I'm looking at how I can show the scale of what we're doing collectively in one picture, in one frame, that when you look at it and you go, oh, okay, I get it. I get the scale that's going on here. I mean, I have a 1985 picture of a Bingham Valley, which is a copper mine. And to me, it was the first time it really sunk into me, like what the camera can do that almost nothing else does in the same way. Like film doesn't do it. Because in film, we go on a journey with somebody, and I can show you the exact same open pit mine and do a kind of pan across, or even sit on it for a minute and while the music and narration is going and go on to somewhere else. By the end of the film, even if I included that mine, that Kennecott copper mine, it wouldn't remain in your memory bank in the same way. Whereas when I photographed it, it has this kind of really almost Colosseum amphitheater feel to it. 60, 70 benches, and each bench is like 50 meters, you know. And so you start to realize the kind of grand scale. And then you see a little banana bus and a big print, and it's, you know, for the school buses.
You got a point of reference now.
And then all of a sudden, that's the school bus, and there's a train, and then and you go, okay, wow. And to me, it was this way in which, by being able to find those kinds of moments, it's a kind of an inversion of the classic romantic sense of the sublime, where you know, we are standing in the presence of a gale force wind and a storm at the sea, and a wind that'll take ships down, you know, and you're looking at the sky, and we are diminished in that minute, and we are awestruck and diminished and feel a force of something greater than us. And I think that when you look at a picture like that, like, we are diminished in a theater of our own creation, you know, and so the sublime is an inverted now. Now we are the small bit players in a world that we've created that's so big that we are just little players in it. And there's another organizational collective cooperative thing that we do together as a collective that can make things at that scale. And so I'm kind of almost like the alien coming to visit the planet and trying to tell the other intelligence on the other planet that sent me, like, what we're up to on this planet.
And I don't know, somebody coming to it as an adult who's imposing all kinds of other understandings and political realities and facts could look at that and say, what have we wrought? And a child standing next to that adult would look at that and say, cool.
Yeah. Ooh, look at that. Yeah.
Look at this. Also just, I think that's it, is that you are not humbled before the epic grandeur of God's creation. You're humbled in this other way. Maybe humbled is the wrong word, because there is almost a sense of, like, I can't believe we did that. I can't believe that we could affect.
Or look at what we're capable of.
Look at what we're capable of. And I don't know, it's a weird mixture of, like, is that a stupid pride versus, like, oh, we better watch it. I don't know. I think it's all kind of in the mix.
And I do. And I don't dislike the idea of the fact that somebody could be looking at something and there's a floating point meaning. In other words, that you can address it for, oh my God, look at, you know, what's happening to the natural world, and it's been getting crushed underneath that kind of activity or whatever. Or somebody goes, wow, you know, I've never seen something like that before, and I know our stuff comes from. And then somebody can think of it as a beautiful work of art, and that it just, you know, sits beautifully in their room and they live with it, and it has all these different ways that it can come at you. So that kind of floating point, I think, it's an unstable situation. So it isn't like you only see this one way. And it would actually change it if I went in there and wrote about it saying, this is a copper mine and it's caused this and this much damage downstream, all the negative things I could ever think of. And then that's the thing that I associate with that picture. And then that whoever owns that picture reads that. That's my intention. And now I've colored.
Now you've ruined it, because it's the riddle that keeps it alive.
That's right. And now they're going to see it that way, because that's why I meant it to be seen. And they say, well, I can't see it for other things.
Different ways of seeing, and different ways of, like, the difference between journalism and art, I guess. My relationship with mines, I never set foot in a mine. The most I've had to do with mines is I published my colleague's series on mining. So what did my colleagues look at? They're journalists. So what are they looking for? Stories about the problems with mines. So we ran stories about orphaned wells and human rights abuses for Canadian companies operating overseas and people dying, industrial accidents and explosions, pollution, contamination of indigenous lands. Like, that's what I think of. That's my relationship with mines, fun stuff like that. And then we see your pictures of mining, which, like, completely different and challenging. Because they're beautiful, challenging in all the ways that we described. They don't give that information, but they leave you with something different.
And the information in the books that I do, and mining has been my longest standing series. So I started doing mines. So I worked in the mines in the late 70s. And then the first mines that I photographed were in Pennsylvania in 1981. And then it occurred to me that this could be an interesting project. And then in 1982, I end up in Sudbury and Inco and start photographing the Inco mines, all the mines around there, got access into them and all of that. And then in 83, I go across country and start photographing mines all across the country. So I'm still photographing mines. And it is a kind of a paradox, or there's a conundrum to it, in that we need the material to kind of carry on and to do what we do. And in fact, you know, I've been working with some, I'm now continuing to do some, and I'm working on concluding that project in the next couple of years and doing a book on it. But what it occurred to me is that being a photographer and having gone from being an analog photographer, 8x10 negative, 4x5 negative, to now shooting only digital and printing digitally, that's a paradigm shift of going from a consumer-based medium, which is I'm consuming chemistry, silver, plastics, gelatins, paper, all of that to make my prints, to now with your phone or with your digital camera, you just click and there's like zero cost and there's zero consumption.
Yeah.
Now that ones and zeros is creating my images.
No more stuff involved.
No more stuff.
No more atoms.
And if you think, and when I start to think about how do we as a collective species, the 8 billion of us, save the planet, well, we have to do a paradigm shift, except now we have to stop burning coal, oil, and gas. Probably stop cutting down the forest as much as we do and making as much farmland as we do and all of that. So we've got to pull back on all of these things, and now we have to start generating our electricity through solar, wind farms, geothermal, wave technology, you know, fusion, whatever. All we need all of it. You know, one of the interesting things I was, you know, one of the miners that I was working with, Robert Friedland, and I went to the DRC and he opened one of the biggest copper mines in the last decade that's opened up, and they're about to be doing 800,000 tons of copper per year. And we collectively mine about 35 million tons of copper per year. But if you look at the beginning of the copper age, which is 5,000 BC till now, that's 7,000 years, the estimate is about 750 million tons of copper has been mined and is in our human systems. But to get to net zero by 2050, we need to mine that much again from the very beginning of time in the next 25 years to get to net zero.
We need to do in the next 25 years
what we did from the beginning of
harvesting, time until now.
Yeah, of us harvesting copper. And that's just copper. That's not metal. That's not lithium. That's not cobalt. That's not aluminum. That's just copper. But all of them have the same almost equation. And that's because we need heat pumps, electric cars, ways in which we can heat our homes, move us around, and create cooling and heating and all that. So that is all has to be done.
We need to massively accelerate industrialization to deal with the impacts of industrialization.
And that was before AI. And the footprint of AI is going to do to pull copper and aluminum and steel into it to build the data centers that are going to generate AI
I see. To fuel
just
AI.
I'm talking about pure materials.
Right.
Like so the silicon, the copper, the aluminum to make all those data centers. That's not small. And all electricity to feed those data centers and all of the nuclear power plants and all of that.
Right. That doesn't even take into account our new demands.
That's right.
You were talking earlier about how if you were accusatory rather than revelatory, it would be pretty hard to get access to some of these places. And that leads me to wonder, has anyone turned you down? I know that you go directly to CEOs to request access to massive industrial projects, and you've had incredible success getting that access. Have you been denied that access?
Oh, yeah. I only get maybe somewhere between 50 and 60% of what I ask for. So, yeah. So it's not like everybody's flinging doors open. And it's gotten worse. It's gotten worse because there's, I think, in the world of social media, in the world of, you know, how quickly things can get blown up and blown out of proportion and distorted and all of that, I think there's a feeling now that why even open the door and invite even the chance of something like that happening. I've been able to get into some places in China, and I would actually like to go back to China. I got into BYD about 2 years ago to photograph the largest car manufacturer in the world, one of the largest battery manufacturers in the world. And just to give you scale, they had never let any other photographer ever in, and I managed to find my way into it through some great connections. But like when I photographed there, they had 750,000 employees, 75,000 engineers, you know, building their batteries and cars, just to give you
Did you say 750,000 employees?
That's now gone to 1 million.
And where is it?
It's in China, near Shanghai. It's about an hour drive out of Shanghai.
Uh-huh.
And they're now the largest electric car manufacturing. Literally.
That's wild. Are you at liberty to say any of the places that wouldn't let you come photograph?
You know, I tend to forget about them if they did. There were a few places. I'm trying to think of something recently. I remember once, it's a funny story, but I did a chicken packing plant in China. And at first they said yes. And then as we were driving there, they called up and said no. And we said, no, our crew is going and we're going to go do it. And we got in there and we just said, I've come from Canada. You can't do this. And they let us in.
Uh-huh.
I photographed it. And then I got a call from the PR department that was doing some work for Maple Leaf Foods. And they said, can we show that picture of the chicken packing plant in China? And I said, on one condition. And they go, what? Did I get to photograph your plant?
Right.
No way. No way. So it was kind of funny. I said, well, what do you mean? We could put them side by side.
Yeah.
They didn't find the humor in that at all.
No. Ed Bertinsky, thank you.
Thank you.
That is your Canada Land for this week. I hope you liked today's show. If you did, if you didn't, email me. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing is from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode is fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Our director of audio is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher here at Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to